He was the Renaissance golden boy, handsome, brilliant, and athletic, until he wasn't. He shattered a church, married 6 times, beheaded 2 queens, and grew so fat he had to be hoisted onto his throne. He claimed divine dreams. He kept a polar bear. He had his servants wipe his royal behind. One moment, he wrote love songs. The next, he signed your death warrant over his 13th roast duck. This is Henry VIII, England's most terrifying, fascinating, and bizarre king. Well, you've heard this name before, but usually people only bring it up when you talk about his wives. Henry VIII, a monarch who reshaped England forever, but just about burnt everything down to do it. And a walking contradiction, because in the beginning, as Anthony and I will discuss in just a moment, he was a genius, a Renaissance poster boy, medieval super king, and then very quickly went into a paranoid butcher, a despot, a national embarrassment, all wrapped in fur, jewels, and a terrible smell.
I think that's probably that sums it up nicely.
Is that all we need to say?
Yeah, I think it's all we need to say. But you know that so Henry VIII. First of all, I mean, which I think it's difficult to go back too far, but the War of the Roses precipitated a lot of this. You know,
sure.
So it was a lot in his mind. There were two, what I believe. And Gareth, I know you know a little bit more about Henry IV, but he obviously had a lot of negative sides to him, but great warrior.
Edward IV.
So apologies. Edward IV, great warrior. And very short, the Yorkish line. It was a very short reign. But the way he got power and the way he handled things, and he was a true leader. And then this youngster growing up, and he had to hide away, you know, because he was part of the Lancastrians. And Henry Tudor, and he's with his dad, Jasper Tudor, and he came back across, and he effectively he had to battle Richard,
at
Bosworth Field. He was Edward the Fourth's brother, mm-hmm. And famously, we won't get into Richard the Third, but Richard the Third was often portrayed as this hunchback. So this hunchback and scary, and he allegedly murdered the two princes.
Yeah.
So the legacy of Edward IV, and ultimately in the end, Henry Tudor, who was Henry VII, came along, flattened all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Boswell Field, like you said,
mm-hmm.
and then he brought everything together. At the time, England, then there was a lot of riches. He left the coffers quite full for his son. And so Henry VIII, he had that background, and he was with his father. His father obviously was very, very particular in terms of the royals.
His father was like an accountant.
He's like an accountant.
Henry VII, maybe because he had this conquest at Bosworth that meant that he wasn't necessarily of the most senior royal lineage, he was always trying to prove that he was not a usurper. And Henry VII put all of his energy into making sure that the government was as effectively run as possible. You're not wrong. That the coffers were full. And when Henry VIII, who at that stage wasn't his heir, because remember, Henry VIII had an older brother called Arthur, King Arthur. He would have been King Arthur, and he died young. And that threw everything into disarray. But I think all of Henry VII's energy was packed into making sure that his heir had the best chance possible of being a proper Renaissance prince and of making England a powerful nation. So I'm really glad you gave the history, because it may all play a role in why Henry is considered so controversial by so many people.
Yeah, 100%. And we talk about the prince. So Arthur, so again, they were looking back at their forefathers.
Mm-hmm.
In King Arthur would have been insane. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how it's never been done again, you know, mm-hmm. Since then. But at the time, there were 4 princes that were born within 10 years of each other. And you'll see how their lives get played out. And some have got more power than the others. And it just – and you see how their lives intertwine in certain ways. But it was Henry VIII, as we know, then Suleiman the Magnificent.
Right, which, of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, the Ottoman Sultanate, also born within 10 years of Henry VIII. Charles V, who became insanely powerful.
Habsburg of Spain,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, and yeah. He was particularly ugly. So
yes, I think take a look. Anybody who's listening to this now, when we finished the podcast, Google Emperor Henry V.
Yes,
and you'll see.
Yeah, I think if with the big jaw,
not great.
And then the fourth one is Francis I, the King of France. So those four grew up and they would play big roles. They would meet each other. I think Henry VIII didn't have a lot to do with Suleiman. Yeah, but Suleiman had a lot to do with the. With Italy and he was very interested in it and then clashing with Charles V, clashing with Francis. So there was a lot going on at that time, and I think it was a great time to be king. But sadly, playing forward, England was the poorer of
was.
If you look at all four in the end, they ended up being the poorer of the four. They were almost put aside, and that frustrated Henry.
Yeah, I mean, he was hugely and intensely competitive. But at the same time, as these four great rulers that you mentioned, and all of them were exceptional, this is the time of Leonardo da Vinci, of Michelangelo, of Raphael, of Donatello, of all of these incredible, talented geniuses, these people who were taking art and innovation to new heights and in new directions. Lorenzo de' Medici, of Florence. We had incredibly novel stuff coming out of Europe at that stage. And really, it was Henry in England who embodied all the hopes of his father and his people at that time. And he lived up to it for a very long time. He was intelligent. Yeah. He was athletic. He was charming. He spoke multiple languages.
So how they describe him, 6 foot tall. Mm-hmm. Powerfully built. Mm-hmm. So this is when he's a youngster. So tireless athlete. So he's always out hunting. And so he did aristocratic sports, apparently like tennis. I'm not sure what it was called then. Yeah. But they mentioned. And he was a good dancer. And, you know, so he could play music. He could speak a number of languages. And everybody, you know, it's almost like you have a very poor coach in a football team or in a basketball team or in a rugby team. And the new coach gets appointed, and everybody just rejoices, you know, at the fact that this finally we're getting somebody that's good that can take over, and you know, Henry VII, as you mentioned, the accountant, and now you've got this different person, and he knew Henry VIII. One thing you have to admit when you look at the pictures, he knew how to be a king.
Oh yeah, you know? Oh no, he dressed the part, and remember, he became king at 17, so you know you're youthful. And people have just invested all their hopes and dreams in you. And famously, a 50-inch chest and a 30-inch waist and enormous cod pieces, we've got to say. He wore enormous and outrageous cod pieces.
Okay, so what is a cod piece?
A cod piece is like a thing you put on under your belt and above your stockings, right where your pelvic region is. I'm trying to be diplomatic about this in case the kids
are listening. It's like a cricket box.
Like a cricket box, but it's got a long extended thing that comes out of it, which is meant to be intimidating to other people. Henry famously wore the biggest cod pieces. No one else is allowed to have a cod piece as big as Henry's.
Yeah, since Blackadder.
Correct. So, all right, we're going to touch briefly on the wives, but from the point of view of Henry, because we've done an episode on his wives, but there's Catherine of Aragon, this very sweet, very religious, very pious Spanish princess. She's initially engaged to his elder brother, Arthur. So Henry kind of inherits that marriage because his brother dies, which is not a great place to start, but it does start off well. They have a daughter called Mary. And then because of his codpiece, Henry gets distracted by Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
And I think this is where the wheels start coming off.
But it'll later play out because to be able to marry your brother's widow, you had to ask for papacy approval.
Yeah, so, right. So you the had Pope to had to rubber stamp that stuff.
Rubber stamp that, and actually that'll bite him in the bum later on in our story of Henry.
So let's just skip ahead to that, because really that's the gist of it. The Pope refuses to annul their marriage. Henry's looking at Anne. Anne Boleyn's saying to him, hey, if you want some of this, you better marry me. I'm not giving it to you otherwise. And he's absolutely, like, he just cannot see the wood for the trees here. He's in head over heels in love with Anne. She plays him like a fiddle. He doesn't just seek a way of getting around this. He actually breaks with the church. And this is probably one of the most phenomenal things to have happened in European history. Because ever since then, England has followed a completely different path to the rest of Europe. I mean, you had kind of Lutheranism and various kinds of Protestantism already breaking out. But this is the country and the king of a country saying, we're no longer part of the Catholic Church. He dissolves the monasteries. He creates absolute chaos, sends all the friars and the monks and the bishops packing, and basically takes over as head of the church himself, all for the love of a woman. So, you know, as some people have said post then, if you're looking for family values, Henry VIII's not a great place to go, because we know that he repudiated his daughter Mary after that. He later on, when he changed his tune about Anne Boleyn and made up all kinds of stuff to get her head cut off, repudiated Elizabeth. The only one he liked was his third wife, because she didn't live long and she never argued with him, and she gave him a son.
Yeah. And that's, he was driving towards that. But just to paint the picture of Europe at the time, so if we look at the Catholic Church and what it stood for through the decades and through the centuries, and but what had happened in, let's say, recent times were popes that had weren't, you know, as pious as what is required for the job.
You're being kind.
Yeah.
We had popes like the Borgia Pope, Alessandro, yes, who had children while he was pope.
But while he was pope. And that, so Borgia, so Alexander the Sixth, who was the Borgia, he served just before Henry became king. And he was probably the most notorious pope that, and we've actually covered him, so I won't go too much into it, but if just to jog your memory, he's infamous for his ambition, nepotism, his worldly excess, ruthlessness, money-making schemes, and it wasn't only him that did the money-making schemes, but they used to sell slips of paper.
Indulgences.
And there was a significant amount of money you could be earning from that. So, you know, I haven't gone deep into Martin Luther's reasons behind the big drive in Northern Europe, but I mean, there's a lot of people that were really disillusioned by the Catholic Church, and so we come back to Henry and we say maybe Henry was disillusioned, and we could say, oh, Henry VIII started the king, you know, he started the Church of England because they had lost their way, the Catholics had lost their way, and he really felt.
Well, certainly he tried to paint it that way afterwards.
But it wasn't that way.
No, it was all because of Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
He wanted to marry Anne. He couldn't get his way. He had a tantrum, left the Catholic Church. That's basically what it was.
And even what happened, he never wanted to, because he was seen as the protector of the faith. He was actually, he got the
defender of the faith.
Defender of the faith. So even you can see how he actually worked. This is one of the good things about Henry VIII. Once it had been established that it's now the Church of England and he's the supreme head, then he actually worked very hard to make sure what it looked like. And he wasn't at all a fan of the Lutheranism. So he put, and a lot of the stuff, and you can even see it in today, there's a lot of Catholic mannerisms and ways that you worship that are still within the Church of England.
Yes. No, absolutely. It was about this time where Henry had a jousting accident and hurt his leg very badly. So obviously there was, I don't know, a piece of wood, some germs, a scar that wouldn't heal properly. And this would lead to him becoming obese. Possibly it affected him mentally. You know, if you were in constant sepsis, which is supposedly what he was, you start to pack on weight. He would eat gargantuan meals, but he no longer did the exercise. that he used to do as a teenager and as a young adult. So he became just this mountain. I mean, eventually they had to build devices to lower him and raise him from his bed. He was carried around in a litter. And by the time he was married to his final two wives, he was absolutely revolting to be around.
Oh, he was an embarrassment.
So the transformation, not just of England from Catholic to Anglican, not just of this wife replacing that wife replacing that wife, but also the transformation of Henry from this supremely talented and ambitious Renaissance prince into this mountain of a man who was bad-tempered with everybody. I mean, he was signing death warrants all the time.
So he actually completely became paranoid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everyone was a threat. He put people to death if they looked at him funny. He chased people out. He was shouting at everybody all the time. Just absolutely morose, grumpy, awful to be around, and apparently extremely, extremely smelly. So this wound on his leg had started to turn into ulcers. The ulcers would burst. They would clean them all the time. They had weeping sores, just gross things. Apparently everywhere he went for, you know, a couple of meters around him, it was just abhorrent. People would put perfume on their napkins and hold it to their noses just so that they wouldn't throw up around him. They would spray perfume all over the rooms. They'd burn candles and incense. None of it helped. And imagine being those last two wives, Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr, and having to get into bed with him. And now he's trying to, you know, get all amorous with you. And the ulcers on the legs and and I mean, I feel desperately sorry for these two women.
You know, I think that he struggled to find the wives in the end. You know, I think they were running for the hills, exactly. but you know what? He had such incredible ministers.
Yeah.
You know, Thomas More. Then we had Cromwell at the end.
Well, Wolsey at the beginning.
Yes, Wolsey in the beginning.
Only reason he fell out with Wolsey is Wolsey couldn't get him papal approval of his divorce.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's like, off with you.
Yeah.
Then Cromwell. The original Thomas Cromwell, man of all seasons.
He killed him.
So I didn't put down.
So he actually regretted that. But those are the type of things, so the whole regime just fell apart. He was strong in memory. Although his body was finished, his mind was strong till the very, very end.
Well, maybe not his emotions, though, because, as I said, he was absolutely impossible to be around. But he did sign his will that his son Edward would inherit. Edward, the son of Jane Seymour. That didn't last terribly long either. He was a sickly child. But he tried to rule by his father's rules, by Protestantism. He was guided by some not entirely favorable courtiers along the way too. But it's worth, just before we move on to that reign, because maybe that's an episode on its own too. He owned, Henry VIII, most famous maybe King of England, owned 230 pairs of velvet shoes.
Wow.
He had portraits that were flattered dramatically, like the famous Holbein portrait where he looks all strong and he's standing in this very regal pose.
With his septic leg, yeah.
Yeah, Holbein had to hide a lot of stuff in those pictures, okay? So don't believe everything you see. He had pets like lions, leopards, a polar bear that he all kept in the Tower of London. So he had a full zoo going.
Wow.
Just for him. He had his servants wipe his bottom because he couldn't reach it when it got, you know, when he got enormous, he needed help. And he had a guy called the groom of the stool, or they later came up with groom of the stole, which sounds a lot more decent. But this poor guy had the job of, imagine wiping King Henry VIII's ass.
Oh,
that's what someone had to do. And like many people,
although
in
it looks
that
like
era,
he was a few toilet sessions behind.
Oh yeah, a few meals ahead, a few toilet sessions behind. He claimed to have, like so many people at that time, divine dreams. He used to talk to astrologers and mystics. They had a court sorcerer. And this is, you know, completely obviously contrasting with his supposedly religious nature. And the fact that he wrote during his younger years, he wrote volumes of books about religion, deeply thoughtful philosophical books and theological treatises that are held in high esteem even today. I mean, he was not an idiot in the beginning, but he also had a sorcerer at court.
Yeah, so that
And they suppose, I don't know if this is true or not, but they suppose that Greensleeves was written by Henry VIII.
That's what I've also heard.
Okay, so I'm not so deluded. Yeah, so
I've also picked that up. But I think the big thing is, when you look at what you're saying, is he ultimately was directionless, and he led England into a undirectional future, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, the religious stuff, because then, you know, you have Edward, his son, who's Protestant, and you have Mary, who brings back Catholicism, then you have Elizabeth, who brings back Protestantism and is less mean to the Catholics. But it doesn't stop there. It goes all the way to Charles II and James
II
in the late 1600s. So he causes enormous damage.
Yeah. So, but when I look at his legacy, and we've spoken a lot about what he stood for, we spoke his son. So his son really lived too short to really have any, and he was very influenced by what his father said. So, but Mary, Bloody Mary, aka Bloody Mary, she just went on a rampage. But one thing I think he would be, if he had that emotion, which is pride in his daughter, I think Elizabeth was an absolute machine. I think she was really, and that's the last Tudor.
Yeah.
And I think she really,
she finally, would have lived up to the hopes they had for him.
Exactly. And finally she reigned for a long time, but she didn't descend into craziness like so many of these guys do at an older age. I think he would have been proud of Elizabeth.
Well, it's a great note to end it on, but there's so much more to be said about Henry VIII. So you'll have to forgive us if we didn't touch on everything. Fascinating guy. I don't know if I'd like to have been around him, particularly towards the end.
Not if I was a woman.
Especially not if I were a woman. But, you know, he would have killed you no matter what and where and when, or even if you didn't said the right thing 90% of the time. He might have just taken a dislike to you that day, eaten something bad, and off with your head. So it's a good thing he's very firmly in the blind part of history.